Thank you.
Where's your...
I lost it.
I want you to explain your exact concept of God. That's what the question was.
It was?
Trust me.
Jerry says the question was, explain my concept of God.
Exact concept.
Exact.
Specific and exact.
Specific and exact concept
in,
of God.
In some detail.
In some detail. Wow. I feel an affinity for every deity that I've heard about and read about, whether it's Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad. I feel an affinity. I mean, I really feel how wonderfully spiritual teachers they all were. And I just can't get specific beyond that. It is clear that the universe has a very clear spiritual message, and it has been transmitted by some wonderful teachers, including Bill Wilson, to our benefit. And so to me, the zeroing in on, you know, who is God, whatever the source of those principles that are common to all religions and all spiritual paths, that whatever that center is, which no one will ever know, is what I think it is. And, you know, we can't know. We have to just talk about this. And that's why stories come in so handy, to tell parables and stories and all of that. So that's my best shot at that.
It's your turn to pick a question. That was a specific question.
Oh, that was a leftover question. So now
addressed to you. While he's doing that, Todd showed me a portion of the big book, he advanced a thought that I hadn't had or hadn't heard. And it was that when we get people from treatment centers and we get people from the jails or the probationary people with the little pieces of paper from the judge, we don't tell them our stories. And the book says that the first thing we do with a newcomer is tell him our stories, and that allows us to establish a trust with those newcomers. And he wonders, and I think it's a good wonder, is that a reason why we're not making better contact with those newcomers? We don't take that initial step to establish ourselves as alcoholics specifically with them so that they can have some trust with us. I think it's a great idea. I'm going to spend some more time thinking about that.
Sandy and Jerry, I grew up in a family of Jehovah's Witnesses. They constantly try to draw me into this religion and insist that it's the only right spiritual way of life to live. How can I tell them I want no part of that and have a good relationship with them? One of my sons got involved, not in that, but he just got so fanatical and so excited about it that every time I talked to him, he was, "Oh, my dad, you got to get this and you got to get that." And, you know, I was so excited that he had found something that I just asked him to tell me more about it. And finally, he told me everything that there was to tell, and that seemed to satisfy him. And I learned, oh, that's a good point that you're making there, and that's a good point. So it's almost by embracing it, I didn't have to fight it.
Good. I don't know sometimes whether you can. The first part of that question is easy. What do you tell them? And that is, you tell them in as kind of fashion as you can that, I don't believe as you believe. I don't disbelieve. I just am not in a position to endorse the same things that you're able to endorse. I envy you, your belief. I really do. And I honestly do envy people who have got that really rock solid, no questions asked, know exactly how it's happening and how it's going to happen. That's wonderful. I just never had that. And I couldn't develop it. So I have to tell people, with due respect to you, I wouldn't try to talk you out of your belief in any way in the world. But I simply am unable at this point in my life to make that kind of a commitment. Now, what that does to that relationship is not my deal. I'm willing to be open to that relationship, and they may not want me in their circle. And if they don't, there's just not a hell of a lot I can do about that. I simply have to go my way and be as honest with them as I can.
Your turn.
It's estimated 250,000 people in this country have addiction problems, and only 10% can afford treatment. How can more people receive treatment? Well, there's a difference between treatment and recovery. Treatment is a way that people learn a little bit about what's wrong with them or what's suspected as being wrong with them. Recovery is to get over and recover from that condition. The way we can help the people that can't afford treatment is to provide them with opportunities in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to work the steps, form step groups, form newcomers groups, form ways to allow them to find and learn what they would learn in a treatment center. If you talk to people who go to a treatment center, they talk about some scientific babble about what's going on in your head and what the thought processes are, all of which doesn't make a damn bit of difference to the drunk. The drunk is just flat. He needs to know what's all this means to me, and it means to him that the question is, when you drink, can you guarantee how you're going to act? If you drink one drink, are you going to take another one? Do you have an addiction? Only you can tell us. And sit with him and let him figure this thing out, or send him out to the bar like the book tells us to. Let him try to take a couple of drinks, see if he can stop. If he can't stop, come back. We'll help you with it. And then we get to the part where we can help, and that's we just provide the day-to-day support and education and sharing of our spiritual lives with that person, and that's the way we do it. I don't know of a better way.
I just agree totally, but I also recall when I came in, there were just in most AA areas, somehow somebody knew somebody with an old farmhouse. We've all heard these stories, and the farmhouse got converted into a place for new guys to stay, and then there were volunteers go out. And so it was the predecessor of treatment centers that practically didn't cost anything. And we may be going back to those as the insurance coverage drops off.
I hope so.
And, they were really fun to participate in. I forgot. I want to make an amend without breaking any anonymity to a young man I was very abrupt with on my way to the bathroom in answering a question that he had, and I'm very sorry. Okay. Where did we get the name Alcoholics? Well, I don't know. maybe from drinking alcohol.
What they used to call us?
Dipsomaniacs.
It sounds better than dipsomaniac to me. I like it better than dipsomaniac. I really do.
That's right. They had all kinds of other names. But I think it obviously came. from the disease itself. And by the word drug addict came from drugs.
I've never heard it
sex
put that so clearly.
Came from sex. Probably there's a different meaning that was intended by that question, and so I will reserve judgment.
If you're talking about the name Alcoholics Anonymous.
Oh, that's a different thing, yeah.
I heard by legend that in New York, they picked up a guy who was from a jitter joint, an insane asylum, who had a wet brain, and that he had been a former editor of one of the major magazines in New York City, and the New Yorker, I believe, and they were all discussing what they were going to call this thing. And someone posed the rhetorical question, what do you call a nameless bunch of drunks? And he said, Alcoholics and Anonymous Alcoholics, and they just turned it around and called it, that's what we have today. That's what I heard. I don't know whether that's right or not. I'm a large proponent of singleness and purpose, but I find myself at meetings in my district with people just introducing themselves as addicts. The only problem is that in my district, NA is non-existent. How can I turn these people away if AA is their only dying hope? Well, this won't please a lot of people, but I don't. I talk to them and ask them, have you used alcohol? Have you used alcohol excessively? Has it been an integral part of your addiction? And I try to help them find a real, honest way that they can say that they have an alcohol problem along with perhaps another kind of problem. But I don't feel comfortable, I just don't, running people off from Alcoholics Anonymous who have an addictive problem with a drug or alcohol. I recognize that I'm in a minority probably on that point, but that's just the way I feel. I live in a small community most of the time. NA comes and goes almost twice a year. It never lasts very long, and there's some people who really need some help, and we find ways to help them. But I recognize in other places that would not be a satisfactory solution, and that's just the way I see the world.
When you think about it, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking, and no matter what your problem is, you certainly don't want to drink because that's going to trigger it. So we're down to, why are you having such a hard time out of saying you're an alcoholic? Your whole life is hanging in the balance. We're willing to help if you'll do that one little compromise. Otherwise, you're going to constantly call attention to yourself and get the turmoil that goes with it. So there's a compromise on both sides. And win-win. And that's just me. So it's different everywhere. But most people have a component of alcohol in this society. It's almost impossible to imagine that no drinking was done at all. And that the drinking that was done was successful. You know what I mean? And so it's one of those questions where here's the man, and we asked the question they asked years ago, and it's in our traditions, what would the master do? And then we just think about it in those terms, and it's hard to imagine that the master would have said, push him out the door. Maybe I'll just take him home and work with him and try to help him. But I just find it impossible to just say, I'm not going to extend any help whatsoever to you. Bye. It's just too hard for me to do that. You and I kind of agree on that.
Isn't that amazing? I'm a lawyer and a fighter pilot. So,
yeah, boy. Oh, God. How did Mary Alice Bush get in the... Okay, so the rest of you, now why does Mary Alice Bush get in the equation? It's an episode that happened to me when I was drinking, and I was at Yale, and there was the junior prom, and I had met this woman from Vassar, and somehow had gone up there on about three dates and stayed halfway sober. So that it appeared like I would be a good date for to say yes to go to the junior prom. And her name was Mary Alice Bush from St. Louis. And when my roommates found out, they said, "Oh, my God, you ought to marry her. You'll have free beer for the rest of your life." So it was the Anheuser-Busch fortune as my date for the weekend. And... I remember telling myself, "Now you got to really stay sober because this is important." And she came down the train, and then we put him up at the hotel, the Taft Hotel. And while I'm waiting to go to the dinner party, I decide to have just a few gins. In the afternoon to kill a little time. And a friend of mine was holding a dinner party out in Brantford, and I was pretty buzzed when I picked her up to go out to the dinner party, but I made it out in the car and drove out, and there was probably about four couples sitting around the table. And as we got to coffee and dessert, I realized I was going to pass out. Do you remember when you got the warnings? You remember that when the electricity would show up? Oh, shit. So I said, maybe I could drink some coffee and delay it. I mean, I just knew I was smashed. So I picked up the coffee and was just getting ready to take a sip. And I went, and then I woke back up again. And the cup had spun around on my finger. And no one saw it. It just went, and the cup was there, just like I was still drinking my coffee, except all the coffee was in my lap. And I remember going, "Oh," and I passed out. So my friends dragged me and put me in a closet, and as they turned me over, and I'm in my tuxedo, you know, the whole thing, and as they're dragging me down, everybody goes, "Look at that, he wet his pants." And that was the... So they went off to the prom without me, and I'm in the closet, but you know that alcoholics have more lives than that. So a couple hours later, I come up from the dead out of the closet. And I remember getting a hairdryer. Got that wet spot to dissolve. And went outside and just fixed up a little bit and had another drink and went out and hitchhiked. And back then, they'd pick you up. You remember hitchhiking? You could just, the first car that would come, you'd get a ride. So it was colder, and I got freshened up a little bit, and I came into the gymnasium where the ball is going on. Peggy Lee was singing. It was really a big deal. And I'm looking around. There she is. So I come up, and I just tap on the guy on the shoulder, and I said, "May I cut in?" And she goes, "Oh, I'm so sorry. I had a food attack." And I feel kind of, I'm so sorry, but I'm here and I'd really like a second chance. So she gives me a second chance. And so I'm hanging on pretty good and we're dancing around and I'm getting a drink. We're dancing around, getting another drink. And I think I'm doing really good. And as we came around, I look over and there's another prom going on in the next gym. And I go, what the hell is that? The senior prom? I thought there's just one prom. And then I went around and we came around and I looked over there and I saw this prom. I didn't say a word. Then the third time around, I just said, I'll be right back. And she stood there and I took off running into the other prom. And when I hit the mirror, it just, bam, boom. So now I'm in the coat room with my friends, and they got ice on my nose, and I got blood all over the front, and I said, Jesus, what the hell happened? And he says, what are you doing? And I said, I was going over to check that thing out. And as I got closer, there was another guy running out. I tried to dodge him. and we hit. And they're going, you asshole, that's a mirror. I'm like, Jesus Christ. So I'm lying there, and I look up, and here's a buddy of mine that I went to high school with. He went up to Dartmouth, and he was down. I said, Marty, goddamn, how are you? And so I got up, and we went and had a drink. I said, have you seen this gym? Let me give you a tour. This is this freaking thing. So this thing is amazing. Built in the 20s, you know, it's just very gothic and enormous. So I'm showing him all the room. Here's our fencing room. And up the next level, next level. And we got up to where the single skull crew practiced, and they had a little seat, two oars, and you could row inside. I never row, I didn't know anything. And I said, watch, Marty, I'll show you how. And I got in the seat, and I had the oars in the water, and I said, see that valve? Turn the valve on, it makes the water go by. I mean, as soon as he turned the water, it comes roaring out, and the oars are in the water. And it just knocked me right in the water. I just went, boom. And I... Now the water sobers me up. And I go, oh, Jesus, Mary Alice Bush. I got to go down there. So I ran and I got towels and tried to dry off the tuxedo, you know, but it's... Drip, 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 drip. Here comes dripping across the dance floor. One more time, I tapped the guy. May I cut in? And all I can remember her going, never. And so we're trying to get a hold of Mary Alice Bush and hear her version someday. Okay, Scott?
Thank you.
I find that rather disgusting, don't you? Says here, Bill W. suggests other inspirational readings. What besides the Bible, as you do you find has helped you as an adjunct, as suggested in the 10th step? Oh my goodness! I can't tell you the names of all the things. I read a lot. I read everything that Emmett Fox wrote. that was one of the, he was a spiritual speaker in New York. His mother, and always, yes, his mother was the first secretary to the editor of the Grapevine. And the early AAs went over to hear him talk on a regular basis. He has one that was a very famous one with early AAs, I understand. It's called the Sermon on the Mount. I unquestionably recommend to any of you those books, because they are not offensive. They're not contrary to what we read in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think they're very good. I can't tell you all of them that I read. I've got a shelf full of books that I've read of a spiritual nature. Some I like, some I don't like. But for a beginning, that's the one author that I would unquestionably recommend to you.
I'm the same as Jerry. I have a tremendous collection of books. I bet I have 70 spiritual books that I've read. And Emmett Fox, of course, C.S. Lewis, and William James, who Bill read, The Varieties of Religious Experience, and Eckhart Tolle for modern writers, and there's just a whole world. Yeah, there's a whole world, but it's not to replace AA. It is to enhance our vision of what is said in chapter 5 or the chapter of the agnostics. It's to bring it alive and flesh it out so you go, wow, that's what Bill was talking about. We never are leaving the confines of the big book. We're just allowing it to take us up as high as it can. And in both the big book and the 12 and 12, in the 11th step, Bill says our libraries are filled with spiritual books. Check with your rabbis, priests, ministers, spiritual advisors. There's all kinds of wonderful guidance. So somebody will give me a book and I'll take it home and I'll go, man, gee whiz, but I don't throw it away, because I'll put it on the shelf and 8 years later I'll go, what is this? And I pull it down and it's like, oh, that's the greatest book I ever saw. Because that was the time for me to connect with that. But it's an essential part of my life is using the help in broadening the big book. Or me. I'm going to dig around in here. When a person stays sober, we give God the credit. When a person begins to drink again, we blame the drinker. God gets all of the credit and none of the blame. Please talk about this paradox. Okay. Let's say that spirituality is, for example purposes, achieved by getting a suntan. And the guy that stands outside the cave gets a suntan. And the guy that stays in the cave doesn't. And it's the damn sun's fault that it didn't somehow get in the cave. In other words, when I cut myself off from God, there's nothing God can do about it. That's what free will is. I am perfectly free to reject help. That's what makes it so interesting. That's what makes it a choice. And because we have to make the choice to choose God, that's what makes us whole. And so God loves me, whether I'm drunk on the floor or sober, equally, absolutely equally. There's no withholding of love under any circumstance. It is that I won't let it in. And so it's really not a paradox. It is a just a different way of looking at it. I mean, it's just you just can't blame pure love in any fashion. But we can, and it's not my fault that I reject it. It's there really blame is just not a good word to even use in our vernacular. It doesn't accomplish much of anything. That's my thoughts.
You know, you have to think about what God does in the universe. I was in a meeting one time, and a young woman was talking about her problem, and her problem was she had two job offers. And she didn't know what God's will was for her. And there was no boy in our group that talked a little bit like a Damon Runyon character, and he said, "Sugar," he said, "God don't give a damn which job you take. God cares how you do the job you take. We have a lot of free will. God does not direct us. God doesn't decide who gets a flat tire and who doesn't get a flat tire. And the football teams play. Everybody prays. I guess they're praying for victory, but God does not decide which one of them he's going to allow to win the game. That's my belief. I think we have an opportunity equally. There's a line in our big book that says, it says something along the lines that if what we see and understand means anything at all, it's what that every man, no matter what his race, color, or creed, has an opportunity to form a meaningful relationship with his Creator if he has the honesty and willingness to try. But we have to form the relationship. God standing there, or the power, is present all the time. If you can't think of God as standing there, you can think of the power being present all the time. You have to reach out. And if we quit reaching out, we lose the power. And it's not the power's fault. It's what we do is fault. And like you say, I think God loves us drunk or sober. It's there all the time. Thank you.
You're the man, Chair.
Thank you. Could you please give the group your interpretation of fitting ourselves to be of maximum service to God and our fellow man, God and our fellows? Well, I think that the way I fit myself to be of maximum service to God and my fellow man is to remove from myself as much of the garbage that I'm carrying along as I can, to reconcile myself with the wrongs that I've committed in the past and to make the amends that I can make, to do all the things that the steps ask me to do to bring myself into alignment with that power. And when I do that, I think I have done all that I can to bring myself into a state where I can be of maximum service to God and my fellow man.
I agree with that. In the very beginning, we obviously haven't opened up the channel yet. And so our sponsor can show us mechanically, okay, go over and make this amend. Okay, go over and ask that new person if they'd like a cup of coffee. Go over, and they'll sort of program us for what these are. But the point of it is that, as Jerry said, once we get the blockages out of the way, we're going to intuitively know precisely how to be of maximum service. It is simply going to service is automatic. And when I was with Tom Ivester, we were talking about this, and he was talking about service in general, and I said, well, I'll tell you what I think the big bang of service was. You know, where's the origin of reaching out in the hand of AA and all of that? And my contention was that it came from Bill Wilson's profound spiritual experience, after which he could not prevent himself from extending the hand of AA. Part of a spiritual awakening is the absolute necessity to pass it on. You can't contain it inside. Let me tell you. It is just part and parcel of it. And if you don't believe it, just look at his life. Broke. I mean, everything is going wrong. We're being evicted out in the streets. And what's he doing? Well, we're getting started over here. He never could stop passing this thing on. Nobody had to teach him. Nobody had to go, let me show you the service manual. It couldn't be stopped. And you will find when you have this, you just, God, well, give me somebody to talk to. I mean, it is just there. And then we have the whole organizational part of it. But the raw energy comes in the awakening. That's one dimension.
Great.
One more?
You're up.
If God can relieve us from our fatal disease of alcoholism, why doesn't he relieve others suffering from physical and mental maladies? Okay. God relieves us of our fatal disease because we become entirely willing to have God remove the problem. It doesn't get removed until we do that. And so unless someone is seeking a spiritual experience, it can't get in. You follow what I'm saying? It can't come inside in order to happen. And so this could, the 12 steps could very well work on other maladies. I'm not saying they guaranteed or anything like that, because a lot of other illnesses are not composed of mental obsessions. But I would say anything that is composed of a mental obsession could certainly be relieved spiritually. Yes? No?
There's a book written by a man named Weatherhead. It's called The Will of God. It's a little book. And it was written during World War II, and he was an English minister. And women and children and a lot of innocent folks were being killed in bombings on a daily basis. And the question was raised to him, how can this be the will of God? And he answered that question in this little book. He talks about different types of the will of God, circumstantial will, the will of God in this circumstance. What is it here? And then there's the ultimate will of God. To my way of thinking, God does not think that death is a big deal.
No.
Because we all do it. So God must accept death as just another thing that goes on in life. He does not necessarily create the things that cause death. Not intentionally, at least. He allows us to have that free will we just talked about. And in the exercise of that free will, we err. And we do things that cause disease and all sorts of things. But God's interest is and to be with those no matter what. Whether we're drunk or sober, sick or whatever. The power is present for us to help us and sustain us in whatever we encounter. And that includes death, I believe. So I don't know why I was allowed to recover from alcoholism and somebody else out here didn't recover from alcoholism. I don't know whether they chose not to. I don't know whether they didn't have enough willpower left from the abuse of alcohol to make that decision. I have no earthly idea. I only know I believe that this power, no matter where they went or how they went, was available to them, and I hope that they could avail themselves to it wherever they happen to be. Some of these questions, I don't think you can ever come up with a concrete answer for.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we may have done this one. Please comment on dual identification at meetings.
Yeah, I think we covered it. Wouldn't you all agree that? Yeah. Draw another one, Jer.
Whoops. It's all right. We've worn those out. What is your opinion on men's meetings, women's meetings, young people's meetings, gay and lesbian meetings? Okay.
Okay. My favorite type of meeting is one of everything. That's my favorite type of meeting. One of every type of God's characters that there is.
Because all intermingled.
All mixed in one big bunch. That's my favorite. Why? Because I'm hearing from as many different vantage points as possible. And not from other people who see it the same way I do. What the hell did I learn from that? Now, on the other hand, when I first arrived in AA, I never thought special interest groups were a good idea. So, I was going over to a military group at Andrews Air Force Base. Hey, it's all military guys. That was the worst damn thing I ever went to, because there was some new colonel who had about 3 months, and everybody in the room was afraid to disagree with him. You know, there was a sergeant with 8 years. Well, you know, Colonel.
Yes, sir.
And we needed a little old housewife to tell him to shut up. But on the other hand, when you first arrive, I could see where lawyers would talk. And, yeah, you know, lawyers are here. And then, boom, into the one of everything meeting. You know what I mean? So, okay, that's... Because we got pilots and lawyers and doctors and gays and old people. They're putting out pamphlets for old people.
Where?
I got to go read it and find out how the hell you stay sober when you're old. But... Now, I'm just teasing, but I'm coming back to my favorite. You can't beat the dynamics of a steady diet of meetings that have one of everything. Boy, that is what it's all about. An occasional all-men's this or all-women's is fun. But a steady diet, I'll take one of everything any day of the week.
Couldn't agree more. I had opportunity to form an organization in Texas to help alcoholic lawyers. And one of the things that I hope I contributed to that was that we would not be considered an AA group. I did not want to be a part of forming a special AA group because lawyers did not need to go to three-button suits meetings, you know, and try to be separate and from the general population. One of the great benefits when you go to those little bit of everything meeting is you become a part of the general population. You're not special. You're just there with everybody else, and we all got a problem. And that's a great leveler, and it does a lot for ego. And so I agree totally.
Oh, yeah. And there's no Lennies at a pilot's meeting. What should I do if my sponsor comes on to me? I honestly don't know. I don't know what... I can't even imagine that situation. But Jerry, on the other hand... He has that happen all the time.
Well, what they generally do is slap hell out of me. That's what they do, right? Well, I think this. as a straight answer to a kind of a tough question. If you and your sponsor are not on the same page, sex doesn't have any part of sponsorship. Sexual relationship should not be involved between sponsor and sponsee. I don't think there's any way that that could ever work. That's one of the reasons that in our area, at least, they talk in terms of I should not sponsor a woman. And by the same token, I should not sponsor a man if I'm physically attracted to him, and the purpose of my sponsorship is to get close enough to him to make a spiritual, a sexual overture to him. So I don't think that you can inject into that relationship a spiritual interest and have any degree of success. And my answer to that would be, fire your sponsor and get another one.
Thanks. Your turn.
What should a new AA look for in a sponsor? We could talk a long time about that. I did some talking about it in the course of my talk this weekend, I think. I think you need to look for a person who is walking the walk. You need to find a person who attends meetings, who is, you heard the drill, has got a sponsor himself, that goes to meetings, that's worked the steps, that's willing to give you the time that you need to communicate with him. That you have some feeling of trust and confidence in, or that you feel like you can develop some with him. You've heard all of those things, but that's what I think you should look for. I think you should go into that relationship with the understanding for both of you that if a little ways down the road we don't mesh and it's not working, no hard feelings, we'll just realign and go again with somebody else. My view.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I also know the danger of expectations. That this is what I expect to happen as a result of my sponsor. And it may not happen in the sequence that I expect it to. I mean, in other words, once I've made this decision, my job is to evaluate the results. And so if, I'm just making up something, but if for whatever reason he decides to focus on the 12 and 12 for a while and then come back to the big book, and 20 years later you have wonderful sobriety, I don't think you're going to look back and go, boy, did he screw my life up. You follow what I'm saying? Because results are really the bottom line of Alcoholics Anonymous, where you end up with a spiritual awakening. The purpose of a sponsor, from my perspective, is to guide the person through the steps so that they have an awakening. I'm a guide. I'm just going to show you, because you're lost, how to go through this maze and come out the other end. And all you have to do is what I tell you. I'll take all responsibility for everything that you're supposed to do. You just do it. And then you can tell me that you didn't get any results, and then I'd say, well, then I guess you better find somebody else. But it never happens that way. You get results from this. That's the deal.
One thing you should not do is select a sponsor who is not going to be around you at meetings.
Oh, yeah.
You need to find someone in your group or where you're going to be, so you both of you can interact with one another. You should not select a sponsor just because he gets asked to talk around the community or around the country from time to time, because that's not a good reason. That's an ego builder. You should select a person because they have expressed or do express to you that they have the same kind of interest in the kind of life you want to have. And that's what you're going to go for. You may make a mistake on that, but the fact is that should be the criteria. You like their sobriety. You like the sober life they're living. That's you're up.
I'm up. Go yellow. Have you read Varieties of Religious Experience by William James? And if so, how important do you feel that book is to each individual's own concept of a higher power? Yes, I have read it. I tried to read it when I had about a year. Don't think about it. That is a very difficult book to read because he's quoting in different languages. The guy is really brilliant and it's very detailed. But I have read it three or four times, and I just finished a biography of William James. And this is what I think what he was trying to share with us. He gave a series of lectures at Edinburgh University, never having studied religion before. You understand what I'm saying? He was just a famous Harvard teacher and was interested in psychology and medicine and science. And he was just recognized as a very brilliant man. And so they would ask brilliant men to come and talk to other brilliant scholars. And he gave 20 weeks of lectures over there. And he just started from scratch, thinking about religion and studying religions throughout the history of man. And he was also very interested in the current philosophies, which Darwin was having a great impact on. And we were coming into the humanism and existentialism, and God is kind of being pushed off to the side. And so he's studying religion from that perspective, and he basically concluded that the structural organizations, the bureaucracies of religions, had really contributed very little. And so it almost sounded like a complete put down. They've contributed very little themselves to the world, with one exception. Because of religions, there have been a number of individuals who have had profound spiritual awakenings. And those individuals are the most precious thing that has ever happened to mankind. So it was a slight and a pat on the back at the same time. In other words, they actually gave us nothing except the most important thing that's ever been given to us in the form of awakened people. And so his emphasis is on these awakenings, because that is, and of course, look at AA. What do they focus on? Awakenings, the transformation rather than the structure, the teaching, etc. And so if you're going to read it, it's not helpful in reaching a concept of a higher power. But it is a wonderful thing after you've been around a while to put things in context. I don't know if that helps, but I wouldn't go delving in there looking for a definition of a higher power. Definitely, that would not be a good plan.
I'm still in the nodding off stage.
Okay, that was a boring answer.
No. Not boring. I'm glad to hear it, because you did give me something from William James that made a little sense to me. I just couldn't read it.
It's tough.
I tried a couple of times, and I have the book, but it just doesn't speak to me. it's pretty complicated and pretty pretty esoterical. So I went to something a little simpler. I thank you for being here. Sandy and Jerry, at this stage of recovery, how do you utilize sponsorship?
Wow.
Well, I don't utilize sponsorship anything like I did in the beginning. I more often use my sponsor, the only one of my sponsors who's still living, lives in another state, and it's difficult for me to reach. Four of my sponsors have died. I have instead a group of friends that have similar lengths of sobriety to mine or more, and I have some young people that I sponsor that I value their judgment and their experience, and I have no secrets from this group of people that I'm talking about. I discuss whatever I got going with them. And I may discuss it in more detail with one of them because I know of their experience than I do another. But that's the way I use sponsorship today. I do not consider myself a person who does not need advice or help from other people. I do not consider myself a person who should make decisions without discussing them or laying them out to someone else. But it's very hard for me to find people today that one person that I find that I can use the way I use my original sponsors. It's just been difficult for me. I haven't run across that person, and a couple of people in my past that I used as sponsors didn't want to be called my sponsors. They were discriminating and didn't want to be responsible for me. So they wouldn't be my sponsor. They'd be my friend. And that happened to me more than once. Paul Keebler and Bob White both opted out of that selection process. And they're both deceased today. But they were both my sponsors for a period of time because they served the purpose of a sponsor. That's my answer.
That's almost the identical answer. My sponsor passed away after 42 years, but he'd been ill for a while. And so I have been using a close group of friends who are very mature, and I run things by people every day. I can't think of a day that goes by that I don't get feedback. I believe that the secret to spirituality is to be in a constant state of receiving help so that when I pass it on, it is in a much purer form. And so I want to be getting feedback. I want to get that. And my buzzword is, because some of these guys are still working, and we have this understanding that when I call or they call me, we both say, can I run something by you? That's the secret word to mean less than 60 seconds will be involved. And then he said, yeah, go ahead. And I think he may have somebody in there. And then I just go, this situation, I'm looking at it this way. How do you see it? Bum, 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 bum. Thank you. You follow what I'm saying? I just got verification that my perspective makes sense, or I got even a better idea of how to handle it. Thank you. And so I rarely make decisions on my own. And so I think I will continue with this group. I don't think I will find some one person to replace Bill Terwilliger. That's just what I think. I think I will be operating with a small group of very mature advisors, one in particular for the special situation that I want to sit down for an hour or so.
My turn.
And the winner is, I understand that truly accepting my humanity is a major task at hand. Accepting who and what I really am can bring much freedom, but where is the tipping point when I accept aspects of my personality that should probably be changed. Can you speak to this gray area between acceptance and the power to change? Now, I'm going to guess at what the main point the writer's trying to get at. When I offer myself to be changed, what gets changed may not be what I thought was going to get changed to start with. And so when you offer yourself, I turn myself over, I offer myself to you, do with me as thou will, change what will make me useful, and all of that. There's no limitations that have been placed on that. It may be that something I thought was a strong part of me gets changed, that I didn't see the need for changing. You follow what I'm talking about? So spirituality is a little bit different than psychology, where you are looking, you know, this is clearly something I've got to work on, and this is clearly something I got to work on. And when I go to God, I go, God, this is clearly what needs to be worked on. He goes, I'll be the judge of that. And what gets worked on is what needs to be worked on. Now, you think I did that all right? Do you want to take a look at that? I don't want to miss out on what somebody was really trying to get out of that.
I think the tipping point that you're asking about is that point where my actions or inactions are impacting another human being. If I am interfering with anyone or not providing the help that God would have me provide in a given situation because of some personality, some aspect of my personality, then that's something that I need to change. As long as it's not impacting that, if it's not interfering with my service to God or my fellow man, I don't know that I have any spiritual need to change. But I think the tipping point is where I can be, whether I can or cannot be of service to my fellow man. We're not answering that question. If you run us down after the meeting, we'll try to answer. I don't know that I got an answer, but we'll do that. I have grown up in an 8A I can't read that word. What do you think? You have glasses.
Listening to speaker tapes.
Oh, okay.
Growing up in AA, listening to speaker
tapes.
Okay,
yeah. And the second of your particular introduction, inspiration in your stories. What are guys like me going to do when you guys like you are gone? God, I don't know. We're hanging on as long as we can. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear. I believe that. I don't know who the teacher will be. It may be you. And it may be someone that you haven't met yet or someone you know well, but I believe that as long as you're involved in a group that is looking for spiritual growth and there's an opportunity for people to share, you will have speakers who reach you. my generation and Sandy's generation are not the beginning. There were some great speakers before we came along. There were some guys I still listen to from time to time from other generations. And there's some young guys coming along right now that make great talks, inspirational talks. And so I think the lineage will continue. As the Western Nashville people, I don't think the circle will be broken. I think the circle will be unbroken.
When you're listening to a tape, you're not hearing me, my message. You're hearing God speaking through me. That's where the message is coming from. And when I'm gone, he's going to be speaking through other people. I mean, it's going to go on forever and ever and ever. It's not being originated by Jerry or I. We are simply a conduit of the good news. And that's what it's all about. People say, well, gee whiz, don't you get tired of going around speaking and speaking? I said, you know all we do? We are permanent, perpetual bearers of good news. That's all we are doing. We got good news tonight. Here we go. Here's these staff. And here in trouble. And here's what's going to happen. Here's the promise. Da-da-da-da-da.
Da-da-da-da-da.
Boom. Boy, these people are glutton for punishment.
Aren't they, guys?
I thought you all would be standing up going, okay, all right.
It's enough. Enough.
What can be said about a man always in a hurry for God to remove his defects of character? Let's get on with it, God. Well, I mean, there's two ways of looking at that. I mean, certainly we're all anxious and would love to get the promises to happen as soon as possible. Who wouldn't? I mean, you know, you just would. That's one thing, sort of an eager anticipation, a sense of well-being that wonderful things are constantly being revealed. If, on the other hand, you're getting impatient with God and are interjecting our ego into this thing, in that I certainly deserve that this happen a lot sooner than it's happening, that's going to delay the process for a long, long time, because we're really nowhere near ready when we're in that state of resentment towards the progress that God is allowing to happen. The progress is now stopped until we get open again. I don't know. I'm getting tired, so you're going to hear weird stuff now. I guess you
could
always
say
hear
good
weird
luck.
Stuff.
Good luck. Because you're not going to rush God. Just not going to happen. It's going to happen in God's time, sometimes quicker than you want, sometimes slower. But it's in God's time. And, you know, you just got to take an even strain to this thing. This is not a quick fix. We're on the wrong, long road.
What's that? That's it. Was that it? Okay, thank you. Woo.